In an interview with NBC Nightly News, UCSF biophysicist Jeff Lotz was discussing the prevalence of chronic back pain in the United States. The millions of people watching that night heard him explain, "It wasn't until 200 or 300 years ago that we lived past age 45, so our spines really haven't evolved to the point where they can maintain this upright posture with these large gravity loads for the duration of our lives." Exhibit B. In an otherwise solid book about women in prehistory, The Invisible Sex, an archaeologist, an anthropologist, and an editor of one of the world's leading science magazines team up to imagine the life of a typical woman they call Ursula, living in Europe 45,000 years ago. "Life was hard," they write, "and many, especially the young and the old, died of starvation in winter and accidents of one sort or another, as well as disease." Ursula, having had her first daughter at age 15, lived long enough to see her first granddaughter, dying at the ripe old age of 37. Exhibit C. In a New York Times article, James Vaupel, director of the Laboratory of Survival and Longevity at the Max Planck Institute for Demographic Research, explains there is no fixed lifespan. Dr. Vaupel points to the increase in life expectancy from 1840 to today in countries where the figure is rising quickest, and notes that this increase is linear, absolutely linear, with no evidence of any decline or tapering off. From this, he concludes, there is no reason that life expectancy can't continue to go up 2 to 3 years per decade. Except that there is. At some point, all the babies who can survive to adulthood do. Further advances will be slight. When does life begin? When does it end? The preceding numbers are just as fantastical as the ones we came up with for our average height expectancy estimate. They are, in fact, based upon the same erroneous calculation distorted by high infant mortality rates. When this factor is eliminated, we see that prehistoric humans who survived beyond childhood typically lived from 66 to 91 years, with higher levels of overall health and mobility than we find in most Western societies today. It's a game of averages, you see. While it's true that many infants and small children died in prehistoric populations, as indicated by the larger numbers of infant skeletons in most burial sites, these skeletons tell us nothing about what constituted a ripe old age. Life expectancy at birth, which is the measure generally cited, is far from an accurate measure of the typical lifespan. When you read, "At the beginning of the 20th century, life expectancy at birth was around 45 years. It has risen to about 75, thanks to the advent of antibiotics and public health measures that allow people to survive or avoid infectious diseases," keep in mind that this dramatic increase is much more a reflection of increased infant survival than of adults living longer. In Mozambique, where one of us was born and raised, the average life expectancy at birth for a man is currently, tragically, about 42 years. But Casilda's father was 93 when he died, riding his bicycle right to the end of the road. He was old. A 40-year-old is not even in Mozambique. No doubt many prehistoric infants died from disease or harsh conditions, as do the infants of other primates, human foragers, and modern Mozambicans. But many anthropologists agree it's likely that a large portion of infant mortality, once attributed to starvation and disease, probably resulted from infanticide. They argue that foraging societies limited the number of infants so they wouldn't become a burden to the group, or allow overly rapid population growth to strain food supplies. Horrific as it may be for us to contemplate, infanticide is anything but a rarity, even today. Anthropologist Nancy Shepherd Hughes studied contemporary infant deaths in northeast Brazil, where about 20% of infants die in their first year. She found that women consider the deaths of some children a blessing if the babies were lethargic and passive. Mothers told Shepherd Hughes they were children who wanted to die, whose will to live was not sufficiently strong or developed. Shepherd Hughes found that these children received less food and medical attention than their more vigorous siblings. Joseph Birdsell, one of the world's greatest scholars of Australian Aboriginal culture, estimated that as many as half of all infants were intentionally destroyed. Various surveys of contemporary pre-industrial societies conclude that anywhere from half to three-quarters of them practice some form of direct infanticide. Lest we start feeling too smug in our compassion and superiority, recall the foundling hospitals of Europe. The number of babies delivered to near-certain death in France rose from 40,000 in 1784 to almost 140,000 by 1822. By 1830, there were 270 revolving boxes in French foundling hospital doors, specially designed to protect the anonymity of those depositing unwanted infants. 80 to 90% of these children are estimated to have died within a year of arrival. Once our ancestors began cultivating land for food, they were running on a wheel, but never fast enough. More land provides more food, and more food means more children born and fed. More children provide more help on the farm and more soldiers. But this population growth creates demand for more land, which can be won and held only through conquest and war. Put another way, the shift to agriculture was accelerated by the seemingly irrefutable belief that it's better to take strangers' land, killing them if necessary, than to allow one's own children to die of starvation. Closer to our own time, the BBC reports that as many as 15% of the reported deaths of female infants in parts of southern India are victims of infanticide. Millions more die in China, where female infanticide is prevalent and has been for centuries. A late 19th century missionary living in China reported that of 183 sons and 175 daughters born in a typical community, 126 of the sons lived to age 10, 69%, while only 53 of the daughters made it that far, 30%. China's one-child policy, combined with the cultural preference for sons, has only worsened the already dismal odds of survival for female infants. There are also problematic cultural assumptions lurking within demographers' calculations in which life is assumed to begin at birth. This view is far from universal. Societies that practice infanticide don't consider newborn infants full human beings. Rituals ranging from baptism to naming ceremonies are delayed until it is determined whether or not the child will be permitted to live. If not, from this perspective, the child was never fully alive anyway.
Is 80 the new 30? Cartoon in the New Yorker. Two cavemen are shown chatting, one of whom is saying, "Something's just not right. Our air is clean. Our water is pure. We all get plenty of exercise. Everything we eat is organic and free range. And yet nobody lives past 30.
Statistical distortions due to infanticide are not the only source of confusion concerning prehistoric longevity. As you might imagine, it's not so easy to determine the age at death of a skeleton that's been in the ground for thousands of years. For various technical reasons, archaeologists often underestimate the age at death. For example, archaeologists estimated the ages at death of skeletons taken from mission cemeteries in California. After the estimates had been made, written records of the actual ages at death were discovered. While the archaeologists had estimated that only about 5% had lived to age 45 or beyond, the documents proved that seven times that many, 37%, of the people buried in these cemeteries were over 45 years of age when they died. If estimates can be so far off on skeletons just a few hundred years old, imagine the inaccuracies with remains that are tens of thousands of years old. One of the most reliable techniques archaeologists use to estimate age at death is dental eruption. They look at how far the molars have grown out of the jawbone, which indicates roughly how old a young adult was at death. But our wisdom teeth stop erupting in our early to mid-30s, which means that archaeologists note the age at death of skeletons beyond this point as 35+. This doesn't mean that 35 was the age of death, but that the person was 35 or older. He or she may have been anywhere from 35 to 100 years old. Nobody knows. Somewhere along the line, this notation system was mistranslated in the popular press, leaving the impression that our ancient ancestors rarely made it past 35. Big mistake. A wide range of data sources, including even the Old Testament, point to a typical human lifespan of anywhere from 70, 70 to over 90 years. In one study, scientists calibrated brain and body weight ratios across different primates, arriving at an estimate of 66 to 78 years for Homo sapiens. These numbers bear up under observation of modern-day foragers. Among the Kumsan, Hadza, and Aceh, societies in Africa and South America, a female who lived to 45 could be expected to survive another 20, 21.3, and 22.1 years, respectively. Among the Kumsan, most people who reach 60 could reasonably expect to live another 10 years or so, active years of mobility and social contribution. Anthropologist Richard Lee reported that 1 in 10 of the Kung he encountered in his time in Botswana were over 60 years of age. As mentioned in previous chapters, it's clear that overall human health, including longevity, took a severe hit from agriculture. The typical human diet went from extreme variety and nutritional richness to just a few types of grain, possibly supplemented by occasional meat and dairy. The Aceh diet, for example, includes 78 different species of mammal, 21 species of reptiles and amphibians, more than 150 species of birds, and 14 species of fish, as well as a wide range of plants. In addition to the reduced nutritional value of the agricultural diet, the diseases deadliest to our species began their dreadful rampage when human populations turned to agriculture. Conditions were perfect. High-density population centers stewing in their own filth, domesticated animals in close proximity, adding their excrement, viruses, and parasites to the mix, and extended trade routes facilitating the movement of contagious pathogens from populations with immunity to vulnerable communities. When James Larrick and his colleagues studied the still relatively isolated Guarani Indians of Ecuador, they found no evidence of hypertension, heart disease, or cancer, no anemia or common cold, no internal parasites, no sign of previous exposure to polio, pneumonia, smallpox, chickenpox, typhus, typhoid, syphilis, tuberculosis, malaria, or serum hepatitis. This is not as surprising as it may seem, given that almost all these diseases either originated in domesticated animals or depend upon high-density population for easy transmission. The deadliest infections, diseases, and parasites that have plagued our species could not have spread until after the transition to agriculture. Table 3. Deadly diseases from domesticated animals. Human disease, measles. Animal source, cattle, rinderpest. Tuberculosis, cattle. Smallpox, cattle, cowpox. Influenza, pigs and birds. Pertussis, pigs and dogs. Falciparum malaria, birds. The dramatic increases in world population that paralleled agricultural development don't indicate increased health, but increased fertility. More people living to reproduce, but lower quality of life for those who do. Even Edgerton, who repeatedly tells the longevity lie, foragers' lives are short, life expectancy at birth ranges between 20 and 40 years, has to agree that, somehow, foragers manage to be healthier than agriculturalists. Agriculturalists throughout the world were always less healthy than hunters and gatherers. The urban populations of Europe, he writes, did not match the longevity of hunter-gatherers until the mid-19th or even 20th century. That's in Europe. People living in Africa, most of Asia, and Latin America have still not regained the longevity typical of their ancestors, and, thanks to chronic world poverty, global warming, and AIDS, it's unlikely they will for the foreseeable future. Once pathogens mutate into human populations from domesticated animals, they quickly migrate from one community to another. For these agents of disease, the initiation of global trade was a boon. Bubonic plague took the Silk Route to Europe. Smallpox and measles stowed away on ships headed for the New World, while syphilis appears to have hitched a ride back across the Atlantic, probably on Columbus's first return voyage. Today, the Western world flutters into annual panics over avian flu scares emanating from the Far East. Ebola, SARS, flesh-eating bacteria, the H1N1 virus, swine flu, and innumerable pathogens yet to be named keep us all compulsively washing our hands. While there were no doubt occasional outbreaks of infectious diseases in prehistory, it's unlikely they spread far, even with high levels of sexual promiscuity. It would have been nearly impossible for pathogens to take hold in widely dispersed groups of foragers with infrequent contact between groups. The conditions necessary for devastating epidemics or pandemics just didn't exist until the agricultural revolution. The claim that modern medicine and sanitation save us from infectious diseases that ravaged pre-agricultural people, something we hear often, is like arguing that seatbelts and airbags protect us from car crashes that were fatal to our prehistoric ancestors. Stressed to death. If an infectious virus doesn't get you, a stressed-out lifestyle and high-fat diet probably will. Cortisol, the hormone your body releases when under stress, is the strongest immunosuppressant known. In other words, nothing weakens our defenses against disease quite like stress. Even something as seemingly unimportant as not getting enough sleep can have a dramatic effect on immunity. Sheldon Cohen and his colleagues studied the sleep habits of 153 healthy men and women for 2 weeks before putting them in quarantine and exposing them to rhinovirus, which causes the common cold. The less an individual slept, the more likely he or she was to come down with a cold. Those who slept less than 7 hours per night were 3 times as likely to get sick. If you want to live long, sleep more and eat less. To date, the only demonstrably effective method for prolonging mammalian life is severe caloric reduction. When pathologist Roy Walford fed mice about half of what they wanted to eat, they lived about twice as long, the equivalent of 160 human years. They not only lived longer, but stayed fitter and smarter as well, as judged by, you guessed it, running through mazes. Follow-up studies on insects, dogs, monkeys, and humans have confirmed the benefits of going through life hungry. Intermittent fasting was associated with more than a 40% reduction in heart disease risk in a study of 448 people published in the American Journal of Cardiology, reporting that most diseases, including cancer, diabetes, and even neurodegenerative illnesses, are forestalled by caloric reduction. These studies lead to the slacker-friendly conclusion that in the ancestral environment, where our predecessors lived hand-to-mouth, a certain amount of dietary inconsistency, perhaps exacerbated by sheer laziness interrupted by regular aerobic exercise, would have been adaptive, even healthy. To put it another way, if you hunt or gather just enough low-fat food to forestall serious hunger pangs and spend the rest of your time in low-stress activities such as telling stories by the fire, taking extended hammock-embraced naps, and playing with children, you'd be engaged in the optimal lifestyle for human longevity. Which brings us back to the eternal question asked by foragers offered the chance to join the civilized world and adopt farming. Why? Why work so hard when there are so many Mongongo nuts in the world? Why stress over weeding the garden when there are plenty fish, plenty fruits, and plenty birdies?
We are here on Earth to fart around, and don't let anybody tell you any different. Kurt Vonnegut, Jr.
In 1902, the New York Times carried a report headlined, "Laziness Germ Discovered." It seems one Dr. Stiles, A zoologist at the Department of Agriculture had discovered the germ responsible for degenerates known as crackers or poor whites in the southern states. But in fact, our laziness seems less in need of explanation than our frenzied industry. How many beavers die in dam construction accidents? Are birds subject to sudden spells of vertigo that send them falling from the sky? How many fish drown to death? Such events are all rather infrequent, we'd wager, but the toll exacted upon humans by the chronic stress many consider a normal part of human life is massive. In Japan, there's a word for it. Karoshi, death from overwork. Japanese police records indicate that as many as 2,200 Japanese workers committed suicide in 2008 due to overwhelming work conditions, and five times that number died from stress-induced strokes and heart attacks, according to Rengo, a labor union federation. But whether our language contains a handy term for it or not, the devastating effects of chronic stress are not limited to Japan. Heart disease, circulatory problems, digestive disorders, insomnia, depression, sexual dysfunction, and obesity, behind every one of them lurks chronic stress. If we really did evolve in a Hobbesian ordeal of constant terror and anxiety, if our ancestors' lives truly were solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, why then are we still so vulnerable to stress? Who you calling a starry-eyed romantic, pal? Many otherwise reasonable people seem to have a burning need to locate the roots of war deep in our primal past, to see self-sufficient foragers as poor, and to spread the misbegotten gospel that 3 or 4 decades was a ripe old age for a human being in pre-agricultural times. But this vision of our past is demonstrably false. ¿Qué pasa? If prehistoric life was a perpetual struggle that ended in early death, if ours is a species motivated almost exclusively by self-interest, if war is an ancient biologically embedded tendency, then one can soothingly argue, as Steven Pinker does, that things are getting better all the time. That, in his Panglossian view, we are probably living in the most peaceful moment of our species' time on Earth. That would be encouraging news indeed, which is what most audiences want to hear, after all. We all want to believe things are getting better, that our species is learning, growing, and prospering. Who refuses congratulations for having the good sense to be alive here and now? But just as patriotism is the conviction that your country is superior to all others because you were born in it, G.B. Shaw, the notion that we live in our species' most peaceful moment is as intellectually baseless as it is emotionally comforting. Journalist Louis Menand noted how science can fulfill a conservative, essentially political function by providing an explanation for the way things are that does not threaten the way things are. Why, he asks rhetorically, should someone feel unhappy or engage in antisocial behavior when that person is living in the freest and most prosperous nation on Earth? It can't be the system. What's your problem? Everything's just fine. Life's great and getting better. Less war, longer life. New and improved human existence. This Madison Avenue vision of the super-duper new and improved present is framed by an utterly fictional, blood-smeared Hobbesian past. Yet it's marketed to the public as the clear-eyed realist position, and those who question its founding assumptions risk being dismissed as delusional romantics still grieving over the death of Janis Joplin and the demise of Bell Bottoms. But that realistic argument is riddled with misunderstood data, mistaken interpretations, and misleading calculations. A dispassionate review of the relevant science clearly demonstrates that the tens of thousands of years before the advent of agriculture, while certainly not a time of uninterrupted utopian bliss, was, for the most part, characterized by robust health, peace between individuals and groups, low levels of chronic stress, and high levels of overall satisfaction for most of our ancestors. Having made this argument, Have we outed ourselves as card-carrying comrades in the delusional utopian movement? Dumb? Is it Rousseauian fantasy to assert that prehistory was not an unending nightmare? That human nature leans no more toward violence, selfishness, and exploitation than toward peace, generosity, and cooperation? That most of our ancient ancestors probably experienced a sense of communal belonging few of us can imagine today? That human sexuality probably evolved and functioned as a social bonding device and a pleasurable way to avoid and neutralize conflict? Is it silly romanticism to point out that ancient humans who survived their first few years often lived as long as the richest and luckiest of us do today, even with our high-tech coronary stents, diabetes medication, and titanium hips? No. If you think about it, the Neo-Hobbesian vision is far sunnier than ours. To have concluded, as we have, that our species has an innate capacity for love and generosity at least equal to our taste for destruction, for peaceful cooperation as much as coordinated attack, for an open, relaxed sexuality as much as for jealous, passion-smothering possessiveness, to see that both these worlds were open to us, but that around 10,000 years ago, a few of our ancestors wandered off the path they'd been on forever into a garden of toil, disease, and conflict where our species has been trapped ever since. Well, this is not exactly a rose-colored view of the overall trajectory of humankind. Who are the naive romantics here anyway? Part 4. Bodies in Motion.
Love's mysteries and souls do grow, but yet the body is his book. John Donne, 1572 to 1631.
Everybody has a story to tell. So does every body, and the story told by the human body is rated XXX. Like any narrative of prehistory, ours rests on two types of evidence, circumstantial and material. We've already covered a good bit of the circumstantial evidence. As for more tangible material evidence, the song says, "What goes up must come down." But unfortunately for archaeologists and those of us who rely on their findings, what goes down rarely comes back up. And even when it does, ancient social behavior is hard to see reflected in bits of bone, flint, and pottery, fragments that represent only a fraction of what once existed. At a conference not long ago, the subject of our research came up over breakfast. Upon hearing that we were investigating human sexual behavior in prehistory, the professor sitting across the table from us scoffed and asked, rhetorically, "So what do? Close your eyes and dream?" While one should never scoff with a mouthful of scone, he had a point. As social behavior presumably doesn't leave physical artifacts, any theorizing must amount to little but dreaming. Paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould was an early scoffer at the notion of evolutionary psychology, asking, "How can we possibly know in detail what small bands of hunter-gatherers did in Africa 2 million years ago? Richard Potts, director of the Smithsonian's Human Origins Program, agrees, warning, "Many characteristics of early human behavior are difficult to reconstruct, as no appropriate material evidence is available. Mating patterns and language are obvious examples. They leave no traces in the fossil record." But he then adds, as if under his breath, "Questions of social life may be accessible from studies of ancient environments or from certain aspects of anatomy and behavior that leave material evidence." Certain aspects of anatomy and behavior that leave material evidence. Can we glean reliable information about the contours of ancient social life, even sexual behavior, from present-day human anatomy? Yes, we can. Chapter 15. Little Big Man. Every creature's body tells a detailed story about the environment in which its ancestors evolved. Its fur, fat, and feathers suggest the temperatures of ancient environments. Its teeth and digestive system contain information about primordial diet. Its eyes, legs, and feet show how its ancestors got around. The relative sizes of males and females and the particulars of their genitalia say a lot about reproduction. In fact, male sexual ornaments, such as peacock's tails or lion's manes, and genitals, offer the best way to differentiate between closely related species. Evolutionary psychologist Jeffrey F. Miller goes so far as to say that evolutionary innovation seems focused on the details of penis shape. Leaving aside for the moment the disturbingly Freudian notion that even Mother Nature is obsessed with the penis, our bodies certainly contain a wealth of information about the sexual behavior of our species over the millennia. There are clues encoded in skeletal remains millions of years old and pulsing in our own living bodies. It's all right there, and here. Rather than closing our eyes and dreaming, let's open them and learn to read the hieroglyphics of the sexual body. We begin with body size dimorphism. This technical-sounding term simply refers to the average difference in size between adult males and females in a given species. Among apes, for example, male gorillas and orangutans average about twice the size of females, while male chimps, bonobos, and humans are from 10 to 20% bigger and heavier than females. Male and female gibbons are of equal stature. Among mammals generally, and particularly among primates, body size dimorphism is correlated with male competition over mating. In winner-take-all mating systems, where males compete with each other over infrequent mating opportunities, the larger, stronger males tend to win and take all. The biggest, baddest gorillas, for example, will pass genes for bigness and badness into the next generation, thus leading to even bigger, badder male gorillas, until the increased size eventually runs into another factor limiting this growth. On the other hand, in species with little struggle over females, there is less biological imperative for the males to evolve larger, stronger bodies, so they generally don't. That's why the sexually monogamous gibbons are virtually identical in size. Looking at our modest body size dimorphism, it's a good bet that males haven't been fighting much over females in the past few million years. As mentioned earlier, men's bodies are from 10 to 20% bigger and heavier than women's on average, a ratio that appears to have held steady for at least several million years. Owen Lovejoy has long argued that this ratio is evidence of the ancient origins of monogamy. In an article he published in Science in 1981, Lovejoy argued that both the accelerated brain development of our ancestors and their use of tools resulted from an already established hominid character system that featured intensified parenting and social relationships, monogamous pair bonding, specialized sexual reproductive behavior, and bipedality. Thus, Lovejoy argued, the nuclear family and human sexual behavior may have their ultimate origin long before the dawn of the Pleistocene. In fact, he concluded with a flourish, the unique sexual and reproductive behavior of man may be the sine qua non of human origin. Almost three decades later, Lovejoy is still pushing the same argument as this book goes to press. He argues, again in Science, that Ardipithecus ramidus's fragmentary skeletal and dental remains dated to 4.4 million years ago reinforced this view of pair bonding as the defining human characteristic, predating even our uniquely large neocortex. Like many theorists, Matt Ridley agrees with this ancient origin of monogamy, writing, long pair bonds shackled each ape man to its mate for much of its reproductive life. 4 million years is an awful lot of monogamy. Shouldn't these shackles be more comfortable by now? Without access to the skeletal data on body size dimorphism we have today, Darwin speculated that early humans may have lived in a harem-based system. But we know now that if Darwin's conjecture were correct, contemporary men would be twice the size of women on average. And, as we'll discuss in the next section, Another sure sign of a gorilla-like human past would be an embarrassing case of genital shrinkage. Still, some continue to insist that humans are naturally polygynous harem builders, despite the paucity of evidence supporting this argument. For example, Alan S. Miller and Satoshi Kanazawa claim that we know that humans have been polygynous throughout most of history because men are taller than women. These authors go on to conclude that because human males are 10% taller and 20% heavier than females, this suggests that throughout history, humans have been mildly polygynous. Their analysis ignores the fact that the cultural conditions necessary for some males to accumulate sufficient political power and wealth to support multiple wives and their children simply did not exist before agriculture. And males being moderately taller and heavier than females indicates reduced competition among males, but not necessarily mild polygyny. After all, those promiscuous cousins of ours, chimps and bonobos, reflect precisely the same range of male-female size difference while shamelessly enjoying uncounted sexual encounters with as many partners as they can drum up. No one claims the 10 to 20% body size dimorphism seen in chimps and bonobos is evidence of mild polygyny. The assertion that the same physical evidence correlates to promiscuity in chimps and bonobos, but indicates mild polygyny or monogamy in humans, shows just how shaky the standard model really is. For various reasons, prehistoric harems were unlikely for our species. The famed sexual appetites of Ishmael the Bloodthirsty, Genghis Khan, Brigham Young, and Wilt Chamberlain notwithstanding, our bodies argue strongly against it. Harems result from the common male hunger for sexual variety and the post-agricultural concentration of power in the hands of a few men combined with low levels of female autonomy typical of agricultural societies. Harems are a feature of militaristic, rigidly hierarchical, agricultural and pastoral cultures oriented toward rapid population growth, territorial expansion, and accumulation of wealth. Captive harems have never been reported in any immediate return foraging society. While our species shift to moderate body size dimorphism strongly suggests that males found an alternative to fighting over mating opportunities millions of years ago, it doesn't tell us what that alternative was. Many theorists have interpreted the shift as confirmation of a transition from polygyny to monogamy, but that conclusion requires us to ignore multi-male, multi-female mating as an option for our ancestors. Yes, a one-man, one-woman system reduces competition among males, as the pool of available females isn't being dominated by just a few men, leaving more women available for less desired men. But a mating system in which both males and females typically have multiple sexual relationships running in parallel reduces male mating competition just as effectively, if not more so. And given that both of the species closest to us practice multi-male, multi-female mating, this seems by far the more likely scenario. Why are scientists so reluctant to consider the implications of our two closest primate relatives displaying the same levels of body size dimorphism we do? Could it be because neither is remotely monogamous? The only two acceptable interpretations of this shift in body size dimorphism appear to be, one, it indicates the origins of our nuclear family sexually monogamous mating system. Then why aren't men and women the same size, like gibbons? Two, it shows that humans are naturally polygynous, but have learned to control the impulse, with mixed success. Then why aren't men twice the size of women, like gorillas? Note the assumption shared by both these interpretations, female sexual reticence. In both scenarios, female honor is intact. In the second interpretation, only the male's natural fidelity is in doubt. When the three most closely related apes exhibit the same degree of body size dimorphism, shouldn't we at least consider the possibility that their bodies reflect the same adaptations before we reach for far-fetched, if emotionally reassuring, conclusions? It's time to go below the belt.
All's fair in love and sperm war. No case interested and perplexed me so much as the brightly colored hinder ends and adjoining parts of certain monkeys. Charles Darwin.
It seems men weren't fighting much over dates for the past few million years until agriculture, but that doesn't mean Darwin was wrong about male sexual competition being of crucial importance in human evolution. Even among bonobos, who experience little to no overt conflict over sex, Darwinian selection takes place, but on a level Darwin himself probably never considered, or dared discuss publicly anyway. Rather than male bonobos competing to see who gets lucky, they all get lucky and then let their spermatozoa fight it out. Øyvind Vinge, who was working with guppies in the 1930s, coined the term sperm competition. Geoffrey Parker, studying the decidedly unglamorous yellow dung fly, later refined the concept. The idea is simple. If the sperm of more than one male are present in the reproductive tract of an ovulating female, the spermatozoa themselves compete to fertilize the ovum. Females of species that engage in sperm competition typically have various tricks to advertise their fertility, thereby inviting more competitors. Their provocations range from sexy vocalizations or scents to genital swellings that turn every shade of lipstick red from berry sexy to rouge soleil. The process is something of a lottery, where the male with the most tickets has the best shot at winning, hence the chimp and bonobo's Hume sperm production capabilities. It's also an obstacle course, with the female's body providing various types of hoops to jump through and moats to swim across to reach the egg, thus eliminating unworthy sperm. We'll examine some of these obstacles in following chapters. Some researchers argue that the competition is more like rugby, with various sperm-forming teams with specialized blockers, runners, and so on. Sperm competition takes many forms. Although Darwin might have been perplexed by it, sperm competition preserves the central purpose of male competition in his theory of sexual selection, with the reward to the victor being fertilization of the ovum. But the struggle occurs on the cellular level, among the sperm cells, with the female's reproductive tract the field of battle. Male apes living in multi-male social groups, such as chimps, bonobos, and humans, have larger testes housed in an external scrotum, mature later than females, and produce larger volumes of ejaculate containing greater concentrations of sperm cells than primates in which females normally mate with only one male per cycle, such as gorillas, gibbons, and orangutans. And who knows? Perhaps Darwin would have recognized this process if he'd been a bit less indoctrinated by Victorian notions of female sexuality. Sarah Hurdy contends that it was Darwin's presumption that females hold themselves in reserve for the best available male that left him so puzzled by sexual swellings. Hurdy doesn't buy Darwin's coy female shtick for a minute. Although appropriate for many animals, the appellation coy, which was to remain unchallenged dogma for the succeeding 100 years, did not then and does not today apply to the observed behavior of monkey and ape females at mid-cycle. It's possible Darwin was being a bit coy himself in his writings on the sexuality of human females. The poor guy had already insulted God, as most people, including his loving, pious wife, understood the concept. Even if he suspected something like sperm competition had played a role in human evolution, Darwin could hardly be expected to drag the angelic Victorian woman down from her pedestal. Bad enough that Darwinian theory depicts women evolving to prostitute themselves for meat, access to male wealth, and the rest of it. To have argued that ancestral females were shameless trollops motivated by erotic pleasure would have been too much. Still, with characteristic awareness of just how much he didn't and couldn't know, Darwin acknowledged, as these parts are more brightly colored in one sex, female, than in the other, and as they become more brilliant during the season of love, I concluded that the colors had been gained as a sexual attraction. I was well aware that I thus laid myself open to ridicule. Perhaps Darwin did understand that the bright sexual swellings of some female primates serve to stoke male libido, which shouldn't be necessary according to his sexual selection theory. There is even evidence that Darwin may have had reason to ponder sperm competition in humans. In a letter from Bhutan, where he was gathering plants, Darwin's old friend Joseph Hooker discussed the polyandrous humans he was encountering, where a wife may have 10 husbands by law. Moderate body size dimorphism isn't the only anatomical suggestion of promiscuity in our species. The ratio of testicular volume to overall body mass can be used to read the degree of sperm competition in any given species. Jared Diamond considers the theory of testis size to be one of the triumphs of modern physical anthropology. Like most great ideas, the theory of testis size is simple. Species that copulate more often need larger testes, and species in which several males routinely copulate with one ovulating female need even bigger testes. If a species has cojones grandes, you can bet that males have frequent ejaculations with females who sleep around. Where the females save it for Mr. Right, the male have smaller testes relative to their overall body mass. The correlation of slutty females with big bald males appears to apply not only to humans and other primates, but to many mammals, as well as to birds, butterflies, reptiles, and fish. In gorillas' winner-take-all approach to mating, males compete to see who gets all the booty, as it were. So, although an adult silverback gorilla weighs in at around 400 pounds, his penis is just over an inch long at full mast, and his testicles are the size of kidney beans, though you'd have trouble finding them as they are safely tucked up inside his body. A 100-pound bonobo has a penis three times as long as the gorilla's and testicles the size of chicken eggs, the extra-large AAA type. In bonobos, since everybody gets some sugar, the competition takes place on the level of the sperm cell, not at the level of the individual male. Still, although almost all bonobos are having sex, given the realities of biological reproduction, each baby bonobo still has only one biological father. So the game's still the same, getting one's genes into the future, but the field of play is different. With harem-based polygynous systems like the gorillas, individual males fight it out before any sex takes place. In sperm competition, the cells fight in there, so males don't have to fight out here. Instead, males can relax around one another, allowing larger group sizes, enhancing cooperation, and avoiding disruption to the social dynamic. This helps explain why no primate living in multi-male social groups is monogamous. It just wouldn't work. As always, natural selection targets the relevant organs and systems for adaptation. Through the generations, male gorillas evolved impressive muscles for their reproductive struggle, while their relatively unimportant genitals dwindled down to the bare minimum needed for uncontested fertilization. Conversely, male chimps, bonobos, and humans had less need for oversized muscles for fighting, but evolved larger, more powerful testicles, and in the case of humans, a much more interesting penis. We can almost hear some of our readers thinking, "But my testicles aren't the size of chicken eggs." No, they're not. But we're guessing they're not tiny kidney beans tucked up inside your abdomen either. Humans fall in the middle ground between gorillas and bonobos on the testicular volume body mass scale. Those who argue that our species has been sexually monogamous for millions of years point out that human testicles are smaller than those of chimps and bonobos. Those who challenge the standard narrative, like us for example, note that human testicular ratios are far beyond those of the polygynous gorilla or the monogamous gibbon. So, is the human scrotum half empty or half full? Chapter 16. The Truest Measure of a Man.
Small. Both chimps and bonobos are far more promiscuous than we are. Our testicles reflect this. They are mere peanuts compared to our ape relatives' coconuts. Franz Duval. Medium. Convincing vestiges of a sexual selective history in which females mated polyandrously can be found in the human male. Perhaps the clearest vestige is testis size. Men's testes are substantially larger, relative to body size, than those of gorillas. Margot Wilson and Martin Daly. Large. Human beings are definitely at the big ball end of the primate spectrum, more like chimpanzees than like gorillas, suggesting that we have long been accustomed to competing via our sperm as well as our bodies. David Barish and Judith Lipton.
As you can see, there is fundamental disagreement over the male package. What are we talking about here? Peanuts or walnuts? Ping pong or bowling? Modern men's testicles are smaller than those of chimps and bonobos, yet they put those of polygynous gorillas and monogamous gibbons to shame, tipping the scales at about half an ounce each. That's about 80 carats if you're a jeweler. Thus, both sides of this pivotal debate can claim evidence for their view simply by declaring that human testicles are relatively large or relatively small. But measuring a testicle is not quite like getting a shoe size. The argument that modern men's testicles would be as big as the chimps if we'd evolved in promiscuous groups is founded on a crucial and erroneous assumption: that human testicles haven't changed in 10,000 years. When Stephen Jay Gould wrote, "There's been no biological change in humans in 40,000 or 50,000 years," he was relying on data that have been supplanted since he died in 2002. This still widely shared assumption grows out of the long-standing belief that evolution operates extremely slowly, requiring thousands of generations to make significant changes. Sometimes it does, but sometimes it doesn't. In The 10,000-Year Explosion, Gregory Cochrane and Henry Harpending show that the human body is capable of very rapid evolutionary change. "Humans have changed significantly in body and mind over recorded history," they write, citing resistance to malaria, blue eye color, and lactose tolerance as examples of accelerated evolutionary change since the advent of agriculture. An example they don't discuss in their book, but might consider for future editions, is testicular size. Testicles can change size almost in the blink of an eye, blue or otherwise. In some species of lemurs, small nocturnal primates, testicular volume changes seasonally, swelling up in breeding season and then shrinking back down in the off-season, like a beach ball with a slow leak. Testicular tissue in humans, chimps, and bonobos, but interestingly not gorillas, is controlled by DNA that responds unusually rapidly to environmental changes. Writing in Nature, geneticists Gerald Wyckoff, Hongyi Wang, and Chengyi Wu report, "Rapid evolution of male reproductive genes is quite notable in the lineages to human and chimpanzee." They go on to note that the rapid response of these genes may well be associated with mating systems. The contrast is intriguing in light of the sociosexual behaviors of African apes. Whereas modern chimpanzees and bonobos are clearly promiscuous, with ample chance of multiple insemination, ovulating female gorillas seem much less likely to be multiply inseminated. Let that soak in for a moment. Humans, chimps, and bonobos, but not gorillas, show accelerated evolution of genes involved in sperm and seminal fluid production associated with multiple insemination. The genes associated with the development of human, chimp, and bonobo testicles are highly responsive to adaptive pressures, far more so than the same genes in gorillas, where females typically mate with only one male. Because they are composed entirely of soft tissue, testicles don't leave a trace in fossils. So while defenders of the standard narrative assume that human testicular volume has remained constant for millennia, it's now clear this assumption may be wrong. Wyckoff, Wang, and Wu confirm a prediction made by biologist Roger Short back in 1979 when he wrote, "Testis size might be expected to respond rapidly to selection pressures. One of the most intense forms of selection will be found in promiscuous mating systems." Jeffrey Miller agrees. Heritable differences in sperm quality and sperm delivery equipment will be under intense selection. Finally, evolutionary biologist Lynn Margulis and her co-author Dorian Sagan reason that men's souped-up genitals, backed by a lot of spermatic firepower, would be worthwhile only if there were some sort of race or contest. Otherwise, they write, they seem excessive. Souped-up genitals? Spermatic firepower? Now we're talking! Indications of spermatic firepower are evident in the differences between a man's first spurts and his last. A human ejaculation typically consists of anywhere from 3 to 9 spurts. Researchers who somehow managed to capture split ejaculates for analysis found that the first spurts contain chemicals that protect against various kinds of chemical attack. What sort of chemical attack? Aside from leukocytes and antigens present in a woman's reproductive tract, more on that later, they protect the sperm from the chemicals in the latter spurts of other men's ejaculate. These final spurts contain a spermicidal substance that slows the advance of any latecomers. In other words, competing sperm from other men seems to be anticipated in the chemistry of men's semen, both in the early spurts, protective, and in the later spurts, attacking. The importance of sperm competition has been debated in scientific conferences and academic journals for the past few decades as if it were a new discovery. But several centuries BCE, Aristotle and his predecessors noted that if a bitch copulated with 2 dogs during a single fertile period, she could produce a litter of pups fathered by one or both of them. And consider the story of Heracles and Iphicles. The night preceding Amphitryon's marriage to Alcmene, Zeus disguised himself as Amphitryon and slept with the bride-to-be. The following night, Amphitryon consummated her marriage. Alcmene had twins, Iphicles, fathered by Amphitryon, and Heracles, fathered by Zeus. Clearly, the ancient Greeks had an inkling of sperm competition. More recently, several researchers have demonstrated that a man's sperm production increases significantly when he has not seen his partner for a few days, regardless of whether or not he ejaculated during her absence. This finding conforms to the notion that sperm competition has played a role in human evolution and may even reflect an adaptation to monogamy. In this scenario, not knowing what his strumpet of a wife was up to at that damned conference in Orlando leads a man's body to hyperproduce sperm to increase his chances of fertilizing her ovum when she gets home, even if his worst fears and possibly hottest fantasies are true. Along these same lines, women have also reported that their partners tend to be more vigorous in bed, reporting deeper, more vigorous thrusting after a separation or if infidelity is suspected. The possibility that the men may actually be turned on by the thought of their mate's possible transgressions appears not to have made its way into the discussion as yet, but note the discussion of porn later. The scandalous implications of sperm competition run smack into the long-held view of sacrosanct female sexuality. It's a vision Darwin cultivated in public consciousness, featuring coy females who surrender only to a carefully chosen mate who has proven himself worthy, and even then she's only doing it for England. The sexually insatiable woman, declared a terrified Donald Simmons, is to be found primarily, if not exclusively, in the ideology of feminism, the hopes of boys, and the fears of men. Perhaps, but Marvin Harris offers a different take, writing, "Like all dominant groups, men seek to promote an image of their subordinates' nature that contributes to the preservation of the status quo. For thousands of years, males have seen women not as women could be, but only as males want them to be." Despite all the controversy, there is no question as to whether sperm competition occurs in human reproduction. It does, every time. A single human ejaculate contains anywhere from 50 million to 500 million applicants, all trying to elbow the